Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. A very special occasion for us in that we get to welcome the new, relatively new, Irish ambassador to the United States. So let me welcome Your Excellency, Ambassador N. Anderson. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much indeed, Adrian. Delighted to be on the show. I've been hoping to come on for some time. I'm 3 months in the job, so I guess it's about time.
Well, it's not like you have been dossing or unpacking, because in the 3 months that you have been, the Irish ambassador to the U.S., it seemed like you've hit the road running, literally. It's great, and a lot is happening.
There's a huge agenda at the moment, and it's true, I'm not even properly unpacked yet. I'm hoping to do that over the Christmas holidays. But it's a busy time. It's always a busy time in this job, but particularly right now, with a lot happening on the economic front, some very good stuff, obviously, and very active on the immigration front. It's always a watching brief in relation to Northern Ireland. We have the house talks at the moment. So, yes, when you add it all up, it's a pretty packed agenda.
Yeah. Now, before we get into any of the into detail with respect to any of the great things that are happening in Washington, I want to talk about you and your trailblazing career. A lot of firsts. It seems like you have not just, broken glass ceilings, you've smashed them to smithereens. And we don't say that lightly. Going back to the EU, the European Union, you became the first female ambassador to the EU,
Yes.
And that must have been lonely, in the sense that not only the first from Ireland, but you were the first, period, heading into the, the epitome of the bastion of Europe. That must have been a little,
It was quite an experience. I arrived in 2001. The years I spent at the European Union as ambassador to the Union were 2001 to 2005. And I had no idea before I arrived that I was the first woman ambassador from any member state of the Union. I knew, of course, I was the first from Ireland, but that didn't surprise me. But when I arrived, I was told we had never had a woman ambassador or permanent representative, as they call it, from any member state of the Union in the 50 years or so of the Union's history. I found it quite shocking. The Financial Times, I can remember it so well, they ran just a small article on it, mm-hmm. and they said, she made history by sitting down. And I always thought, that's the kind of easy way to make history, by sitting down. But it was an interesting experience. At the time, when I arrived, we were 15 member states of the European Union. And I was, as I said, the only woman at the table. And during my time there, when we had the presidency of the Union in 2004, and when I was presiding the very regular meetings of the ambassadors, that was the period of enlargement to 25. We're now obviously 28, but we enlarged to 25. And I was still the only woman. I was hoping when we welcomed in 10 new member states that I might find a female colleague among them. But no, and the first other woman arrived in my last year in Brussels. But I was well treated, and they made no special concessions for me. I didn't expect any, but certainly there was no condescension, and nor would I have accepted any condescension.
Yes. Was it... you went from there to France?
Yes.
And again, obviously, now you're the first woman ambassador, to France, Irish from Ireland. What was that like in comparison to your first posting?
In comparison to my first posting as ambassador in Brussels, in the EU, well, it's very different to go from the multilateral, as we call it, when you're ambassador to an organization engaging with other member states, to a bilateral post, bilateral being ambassador to a particular country.
Right.
So the scene was very different. There were a few things in common because we have very big EU interests engaged with France. Together we defend the common agricultural policy and so on. So I still did a certain amount of EU-related work there. But mostly what I was doing was promoting Irish business, investment in Ireland. Paris, of course, is a wonderful city. It's also a very glamorous city. We have a beautiful embassy residence. It's a combined office and residence that the Irish government bought many decades ago. It was in serious need of renovation and repair and so on when I got there. So I oversaw that renovation. And it really stood to us because image is tremendously important in France, and we wanted to be able to make a statement about Ireland that, you know, this is no little insignificant country, this is an important country. So it was wonderful to have that background and that place to be able to do the entertaining and the showcasing and so on that you need to do in a capital like that.
You come to the United Nations, yes, another a big change from you know what you even to in considering the post that you had taken. United Nations is scary at the best of times for most of us, but that was a posting that you gladly accepted.
Yes, I was delighted with that posting because I had actually done a lot of UN work earlier in my career. My first posting abroad as a young diplomat was to the United Nations in Geneva. Mm-hmm. And I was back at the United Nations in Geneva between 1995 and 2001. I spent 6 years there. It was a time when Mary Robinson was High Commissioner for Human Rights. I chaired the Commission on Human Rights during that time myself, was very engaged in the human rights and development agenda. So when I was assigned to the United Nations in New York, I was in many ways getting back to one of my early loves, and I thoroughly enjoyed and was inspired and stimulated by those 4 years there.
In the United Nations, though, they're great. Do a lot of changes take place? As the decades roll by, is the agenda pretty much the same? Is it different?
Well, things happen overall too slowly at the United Nations, and sometimes you have the impression that the pace of change is absolutely glacial, that it takes quite a while to catch up with events as they're played out in the real world. That's in some respects, like reform of the Security Council and some other key areas. On the other hand, the UN, of course, does extraordinarily important human rights and humanitarian work, and there is quick response there, and it's very impressive to see how the UN...
Much maligned, though. I don't know whether that's... It's an easy target or not, but, the United Nations, it seems like... You know, the media has a great time with the United Nations in the sense that by the time they get something done, it's the foot dragging, the whatever. Is some of that, or assuming that even a minuscule part of that is true, has that got to do, you know, with the membership and the different cultures, different... agenda, maybe some trying to, you know, watch out for their own corner, so to speak.
Well, some of the criticism is well merited, and some of the criticism is superficial and derived from a very poor understanding of how the UN works. As I said, the UN does extraordinarily worthwhile work in peacekeeping and development and so on. The area that most deserves criticism is the operation of the Security Council. And for example, the most frustrating thing, an ongoing situation. But it began, of course, during my time there, with the delay and the difficulty in getting the United Security Council response to the unfolding situation in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a situation where you have five permanent members, each of them can wield a veto. There's no way around that roadblock. If the Security Council or the majority of the membership wants to act, they still have to get the consent of the five veto-wielding members. If that's not forthcoming, then you have paralysis, and the world is rightly critical of that.
Yeah.
But there are other areas where the UN is delivering, is really making a difference.
How
sometimes
are they?
There
yes.
are cheap shops at the UN.
Yeah. You leave New York, you arrive in Washington, and once again, first Irish woman ambassador to Washington. And the first the first issue that you tackled right away was one that's extraordinarily important to Ireland, to Irish America, and particularly to the whatever that number is, somewhere between 50,000 and 70,000 undocumented Irish living in this country. Surely, taking that as a topic, when it seemed like, you know, that there were so many other issues in Washington and issues with the budget, issues with, you know, to have all of this happening, and here comes, you know, Madam Irish Ambassador and says, I want this to happen and I want to meet face to face with a lot of the Republican lawmakers who probably figured out that, you know, what would you have to do with, you know, what is basically an Hispanic issue? What, you know, why would you, representing Ireland, be, you know, that concerned and carrying a flag for Ireland in the midst of something that has to be the most controversial issue, not just for this year, but going on for decades? That first conscious decision on your part and making up the list, you had to be aware that many of the Republicans that you were going to had already been on record, had already, dug their heels then. And here you are, you're going to come and you're going to try to reason with them, not only on behalf of comprehensive reform in the United States, long overdue, but you are going to present to them the Irish angle. And obviously, you are speaking with people who had never been approached to before from an Irish angle.
Well, firstly, I should say, Adrian, I don't want to take too much credit for this. I don't want to present it in any way as a kind of solo effort on my part. The government is very committed. Taoiseach has been active. Taoiseach has been active. My predecessor has been active. So this is a team effort. But to go back to my arrival in Washington, I suppose the human aspect of this was very apparent to me. Remember that I had spent 4 years in New York, and although I was ambassador to the United Nations, and this right. wasn't therefore my area of work, nevertheless you, of course, encounter many Irish people in America during, if you live in New York, you hear the stories, and your heart goes out to people. And the human aspect and the human imperative is very, very strong in all of this. The second thing is that I always ask myself in prioritizing my time, where can I add value? Where might I and the embassy really make a difference. And it seems to me that when you're there physically in Washington with the opportunity to call on members of Congress, that you can maybe by going and sitting down in their offices and booking the time with them, getting the time using the privileged access that you have as an ambassador, that you can maybe turn this into something that really might make a difference. Again, I don't want to overstate things. You certainly can't wave any magic wand. That is beyond any of us. But I do think to go in and sit down, particularly with the Republicans, because maybe traditionally we haven't been so connected on that side of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
But they're the people we need to deliver on this, because of course we have the Senate bill now, and the Republicans control the House. So we're not going to get any bill unless we have the Republicans, or the majority of the Republicans, on board for it. So if you put in the request, and you're the Irish ambassador, and you do your research, and you see where they're coming from, and you see how their Irish percentages or Irish American percentages
yeah.
are in their constituencies, they will always give you a courteous hearing. And in many cases, yes, they were surprised. They think of this as a principally
yeah.
Hispanic issue. And of course, you take care also how you present the issue, depending on your
sure.
interlocutor, because I always present the human aspect of it, because I think that reaches almost anybody. But also for the Republicans, I think it's very important to present the economic case, to say, look, if these undocumented Irish, if they can come out of the shadows, they're going to be hugely contributing members, and they're going to be able to do things economically and be entrepreneurs and innovators in the way that they're constrained as long as they're here as illegals. And also, if you open up a pathway to legal migration for Irish people in the future, you are going to have the benefit of these extraordinarily talented, educated, English-speaking, entrepreneurial young Irish people. So I think it's important to calibrate what you say. I mean, the facts are the same,
yes.
but of course the way you present them naturally is going to be tailored to what you think is going to be most effective for a particular interlocutor.
Right. And you know, fact of the matter is that the U.S. economy is in such bad shape that somebody has to listen to what turned that you can't have 11 million people here in the shadows and at the same time not address what is necessary to bring these people into a system which would greatly improve our U.S. economy.
Yeah, and part of the strength of the argument is that there is such a coalition of groups now lined up behind the argument for immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the Chamber of Commerce, and you have the high-tech companies. And while to a significant degree, obviously, what they're focused on is changing the migration access for the future,
right.
so they can get more highly skilled workers. But almost everybody, I wouldn't say everybody, but the great majority of people now accept that as part of that overall package, you have to address the situation of the 10 or 11 million or whatever it is. Undocumented. Now there are various views as to how you address it,
yes.
and of course the Republican Party, they want piecemeal bills rather than a single comprehensive bill.
Right.
But I always use the term of a convoy of bills that would be able to pass both
yeah.
houses, and a bill to address the situation of the undocumented is really wherever it comes in that convoy, or however far it reaches towards the Senate provisions, it has to form part of that convoy, and there is increasing acceptance of that.
To have the Irish government indeed not just give a nod and you know, to the plight of the undocumented, and actually to get in there and to have, you know, their position well known, again, logically, not any Graham McCree kind of, you know, oh God help us, we have contributed. History will record that for generations and more generations, that not only the Ireland today have a very good and educated high-tech force to contribute, but surely the Republicans or anybody else for that matter would have a hard time in not acknowledging that the Irish contribution to the US, even without all the benefits which they recently achieved, they've done a lot. And you know, it's not as if we don't know from whence we came, or America doesn't know.
Yes, yeah, and there is recognition of that. I mean, let me say again, Justin, something you were saying there reminded me of it, Adrian, and the Irish government making the case. It really is being made at the level of the Taoiseach, the Taoiseach, he's getting in touch with Speaker Boehner again this week. We had an Oireachtas delegation over a few weeks ago that did the rounds, you know, used up the shoe leather on the hill as well. So we're all making the same case. But I agree with you, and it has to be part of the case we put forward to remind people that they owe us, basically.
Yes.
And obviously we, you know, choose the language, but I, and certainly others, but I certainly make the point very directly that we built this country. We helped in a very significant way to build this country. And that is acknowledged, because no matter what part of the country these congressmen or women represent, and they have evidence. And, they, you know, I did a piece yesterday, an op-ed piece in a leading Texas newspaper, and again I used the opportunity to remind readers in Texas the Irish contribution there in that particular state. And no matter, it's the same in whichever district of the country, whichever state of the country you're addressing the representatives of, you can always find ways to remind them of the sweat and toil of Irish people that helped make this country what it is.
For those of us who have been involved in advocacy for the undocumented, we also understand that on many occasions, too many occasions, there was a tremendous sense of euphoria and we're almost there. And those who are here and those who had the stigma of the undocumented, the horrific pain, you know, for people here who can't go to their parents' funerals or siblings or all of that, isn't there a thin line there where we have to say this is not a sure thing, and at the same time remind people that perhaps the efforts through the decades in writing a situation is not being ignored, nobody threw in the towel, but let that not be you know, anything other than a good sense of hope that this will be achieved, and still keep that hope going, keep people thinking, well, you know, maybe it can be done now, but we were never closer than we are at this stage.
I couldn't agree with you more, Adrian, and if there is one thing that keeps me awake at night, it is that very balance that you talk about, because I think it would be completely irresponsible, not to say cruel, to allow people to hope and believe that this is practically a done deal, because it isn't. There are so many potential roadblocks still in the way, and there is no question about that. And it would be so wrong to let people believe otherwise and to plan otherwise.
At the same time, there is the other side of the equation, which you said, that there is a real momentum. Most people would feel that we are closer now than we have been for a very long time. There is such a logic behind it. And when we look at the larger picture, and so many pundits saying the Republican Party are never going to win the White House again, whatever about midterm elections, unless they address this issue because of the numbers of Hispanic voters. When you look, we referred to the coalition of the business groups and the high-tech groups and so on. So this is a broad coalition. We have a bill that has gone through the Senate. We have the Republican leadership indicating that they are prepared to do some significant work on this next year. So it's encouraging. There are grounds for optimism, hope, however you want to term it. And I don't think any of us would be investing this kind of time and effort if we didn't think that there is a real prospect of winning through here. But we have to have all those health warnings that you speak about. And in human terms, again, I'm really conscious of that, that I wouldn't be so irresponsible as to make the situation more of a kind of sure thing than it is.
But yes, it is real. What is real is that we were never closer to it. It seems like that many, and again we kind of lean towards the Republicans because that seems to be where they are between a rock and a hard place. They have established their own positions for such a long time in their in their constituencies, and actually what we're asking them is to ease up on that, and not because you're a nice woman or you're a nice fella, but ease up on this because this is, there is something in this for you as well, and definitely the United States in terms of economy, of the economy here can use something. If you can get add to that, which you have obviously done, is the humanitarian aspects of it.
Yeah.
It's a very good package.
It is, because the point always is, look, this is the right thing to do and it's the smart thing to do. And that's what we have to do. Keep spelling out, depending on your interlocutor.
Yes.
We emphasize both to every interlocutor. But it's the right thing, and you spell out the human case, and if you would want a heart of stone not to be responsive to the human imperative in this, but also to spell out it is the smart thing for America, and that you have your enlightened self-interest should lead you to be pro-immigration reform. And there is another point, actually, Adrian, in case we're leaving immigration, I want to say we've talked about the government and we've talked about the embassy and the consulates and so on, but this is a really broadly based effort, and you know better than I do how long the Irish community activists have been engaged in this, and they've had their shoulders to the wheel long, long, long before I came to Washington or to the United States, and groups like ILR and the OH and the Chicago grouping and so many others. Are engaged
and
in
the
this.
Irish
and
government, yes, and the Irish government supported agencies here from Emerald Isle Immigration, Ashling Centre, and of course the New York Immigrant Centre, and there are so many.
Yes,
but this is this, of course, lest somebody think, well, the Irish government is now rolling in or on board. The Irish government actually has a history of being there, of caring for immigrants. So it's not, it's not, nobody can say at this stage of the game, well, excuse me, where have you been? Irish government has been. And the Irish organizations have been actually doing this, going back to the 70s.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. I mean, from the government viewpoint, the Cecil Fishy Administration for Foreign Affairs, my predecessors as ambassadors in Washington, the Irish government apparatus, if you like, has been engaged in all of this for so long, and as you say, the community, and there is such sense of care and engagement and responsibility there on the part of the Irish American community.
Absolutely.
Leaders. And if we're going to pull this thing off, it's because of that collective putting our shoulders.
Absolutely.
Together.
And when you see a very active organization, you know, the largest Irish American organization in the United States, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, and you know, the fact that they've been doing it for so long and have taken many issues, but one can say they've also served their time in bringing this to, you know, to fruition. And so I'm dying, I'm itching to find out your reaction, and indeed the Irish government's reaction, to the Forbes announcement. This is the Bible of of either good news or bad news. And when Forbes magazine, when Forbes says Ireland is the best place in the world to do business and to start up business and to invest in, wow.
You've cut it. That's exactly the reaction. Wow. It's a reaction.
That's
it. I was really short of euphoric, I have to say, when I saw
right.
it.
Well, I read it three times.
145 countries ranked, and number one of 145 is Ireland. So it's absolutely fantastic. And even in the few days since we've had the ranking and the announcement,
yes.
I can assure you I've been out there proclaiming it, beating the drum. Never will a fact be so widely shared, I think, as this accolade.
Yeah, we all know that everybody is going to hear about it. We just want to make sure that everybody hears about it 10 times. It is.
And it comes on the back
like
of many other accolades that we've had over recent months. And it's so important because, of course, we go out all the time announcing the good news from Ireland, and obviously so much of it is fact-based and statistics-based.
Right.
It's not just us putting on rosy spectacles. But nevertheless, there is nothing to beat the kind of outsiders rating and a well-respected, internationally known rating like this. That says it all. News, as you know well, Adrian, the news on the economic front is generally very, very good. And I'm not trying to airbrush any of the issues that are still out there. But when you look at the export situation, which is booming, foreign investment is doing so very well, tourism is doing very well, and across all fronts, the financial returns, tax returns,
right.
all of that, there's so much good news. The most stubborn and difficult aspect of it all is the unemployment figures. But even there, as you see, we're beginning to make inroads. And at 12.5% now, that was the figure announced in the last week or so.
Yeah.
Of course, it's still unacceptably high. There's a great deal of pain behind a 12.5% unemployment figure, but at least it's headed in the right direction, and it's down from 15% or so. But of course, we know that disproportionately bears on young people as well. That's the case all over Europe and in all economies.
Yes.
Even when you get a global figure for unemployment, you know that for young people, the figure, of course, is going to be much worse. So the emigration, as we know, is happening. There's no point in pretending it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you want people to have a choice. And if they if they feel they need to go, well, then they should be able to bring their skills where they can put them to best use. But even if we were down to effectively full employment, we are always going to have, and it's a healthy thing, young Irish mobile people making a choice to
go and live abroad, maybe just for time, before they come back and bring their skills back to Ireland.
The difference being that this time they had a sense that if the great news, and if the economy in fact does pick up, and if the, despite the horrific collapse of the Tiger, that companies are still investing in Ireland, that great relationship between the US and Ireland is actually that didn't collapse. And most naysayers said, well, that's the first thing you're going to see now, the Yanks will go home and then we're all in the shock rock.
Mm-hmm.
That there is a sense of hope here that's real, and we shouldn't have to wait too long
mm-hmm.
for that to kick in.
To feed through to better figures on the employment front. Because there's no question, and when the history of this downturn is written, when we have fully emerged from it, we will once again recognize what a motor America was for our economy. That the investment kept flowing, new investment, expansion of American companies already in Ireland, exports of services to the US, they're way up. We've of course become more competitive now as a result of the experience of the last few years. But tourism is doing, as we said, so very well from the United States.
Almost 21%. Sorry to cut in on you, but I'm, to get over my own euphoria here. 21% increase in tourism to Ireland this year from North America, and we could shout that one from the heights as well.
And you can take some credit for that, Adrian, because I know that the encouragement you did of folks who are listening to be part of the gathering, that has to have an effect, because the gathering has been such an extraordinary success.
And also the ambassadors that have come, those in that more than 20% people have come back from Ireland, couldn't possibly have had a better time, number one, because every village and every parish and town and province and city measured up. And the weather.
God is on our side for the gathering. But there is something I want to say about the gathering, Adrian, apart from saying rightful tribute to your own role and Irish America, and to all your listeners who were part of it. It's been fantastic. And of course, it's great in terms of tourism revenues, and it's great in terms of the good to be back here. But what I think is so important as well is what it did for morale in towns and villages and all over Ireland.
Absolutely.
That people felt we're not just victims, we can be actors here. And it was such a boost to the psyche. And people got out and were part of it and made it a success and communicated that enthusiasm to visitors from around the world. So it's well beyond, although it was important, obviously, the tourist spend, there's no question about that, I'm not minimizing it. But there's something that's much harder to calculate, but is so valuable and so important.
Absolutely.
And the gathering contributes to that in an extraordinary way.
And while we're speaking of, the great news and the news with respect to foot dragging and immigration and all the rest, we should acknowledge, and I think this government does and is to the forefront in saying, we know that you're suffering. We know, we give you credit for it. And that also to have this influx of people coming in saying, hey, we're here, what did you say, we're, you know, there is something, if it's a great combination, because let's say anybody think that, you know, in our, it's not unique to Ireland, we're suffering ourselves in this economy, and you know, we have a government that say, you know, things are much, I don't know how things are with you, but things are much better than they were or whatever. Ireland and the people who are living in Ireland have really put up with a lot in the last few years, so it must be something for them to say, boy, you know, things are changing, it must be, we must be contributing something to it. It's great.
I think it's a huge tribute to the resilience of the Irish people, because there are, when you find yourself in a situation like this, what can you do but get suited and booted and go forward?
Right.
You can lament mistakes, and of course people will look back and it's right and appropriate, and we can all learn from mistakes we made. But that spirit of the indomitable Irishry that was once again on show to the world, that is something that I have, and you probably have as well, but I've heard it so much remarked on over here.
Absolutely.
With European colleagues that I interact with, of course, as well.
And this was the world.
Here.
Yeah. And but this was the reach out to the world, to the diaspora. We obviously would love to brag that this North America made it all happen, but people in Ireland meeting other immigrants that they haven't seen in 50 years, that perhaps, you know, they were in grammar school with, and they're coming from New Zealand, they're coming from Australia, they're coming from all over the world. What, you know, you couldn't make that stuff up.
Yeah, it was magic. It is magic.
Yeah.
Except that it's real. So
it's real magic.
And it's going to have a legacy. It's not just, obviously, the gathering is 1 year. You can't have every year the Europe gathering. I think they're reflecting on the future in all of the tourism circles. But as you said, people came back, so many people came back, having had such a good experience, and determined that they're not going to leave it so long before they go back the next time, or they make connections that they want to follow through on. And, of course, what we talked about earlier, the spirit that it engendered in communities all over Ireland. That's not just going to flicker and die. That's going to remain and grow into something more important.
Something that is fragile and has been, and still, we can, historically, we were counted among, of course, one of the great successes of Ireland is, in fact, Northern Ireland. And despite the fragility of situations in Northern Ireland, many would say it is barely hanging in there. You, as the representative of Ireland in Washington, do you, where is the line that says, well, wait a minute, now I, you know, there is a British ambassador and I'm representing Ireland, so at what level do you then, in terms of it, do you have to watch what it is you're presenting, that somebody feel, wait a minute, you're overstepping your bounds? Is there some of that, and has there been?
Well, there may have been traces of that in the past, and certainly I was here as a young diplomat in the 80s, and it's a totally different scene nowadays.
No.
Back in the 80s, we never expressed it, of course, in those terms, but there was a certain competitiveness between ourselves and the British Embassy in making sure that our narrative, our different narratives, were understood. Things have moved on enormously since then. I happen to be personally friendly with the British ambassador because we were both ambassadors together in Paris.
Right.
So we know each other from that time, and he's been very welcoming and invited me around to have lunch with the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland when she was here.
Yes.
Just four of us actually sat down for lunch. So it's a very good cooperative relationship. And so I haven't felt myself constrained or braced. In a great deal of what we do, there is an all-Ireland dimension to the story, and we are very supportive of that, and we use what opportunities we can to help the Northern Ireland economy and in every way we can. In terms of the overall narrative, there is a certain balance, because we all the time want to reassure people just how far down the road we have travelled in relation to where we were in Northern Ireland. There's no question about that. At the same time, we need to have people understand there is unfinished business.
Right.
That you can't just shut the book on Northern Ireland and feel that's all fine. We know there are reminders every day of the unfinished business. So thus, at times it can be a balance that you have to carefully judge. We want, of course, investment, we want optimism, we want confidence in Northern Ireland.
Right.
But that can slide into complacency. So I am attentive to that balance.
Yes. And Ambassador, you know, some say that there are so many areas in the world of pure conflict, of under threat of nuclear annihilation, that Ireland and Northern Ireland was a trouble spot. Fair play to them, they tackled situations, they became, Northern Ireland became a template for, you know, reconciliation and a path again towards peace. But surely to God, our attention should be in other areas, and, you know, how much more can we do for Ireland? As a matter of fact, I think that Americans in general feel that their contributions and that their support for Ireland is, you know, it has been measured already. How do you get across as a diplomat? How do you get across saying, absolutely right, however, we need, you know, an envoy, we need a senator, we need Haas there, and if somebody says, what can America do now that hasn't been done up until now? God knows, you've had the, you know, the president of the United States in Ireland, you've had the president of the United States in Northern Ireland, the goodwill is there, what more do you want?
Well, the goodwill has been there, as you said, for years. But I don't think it's a difficult message to spell out that you need to stay engaged. And I think there's a real receptivity to that message here. The President remains very interested. The Vice President, I happened to be speaking with Vice President Biden yesterday,
yes.
And his engagement with Ireland is very, very impressive. So they are interested. We don't need to be trying to persuade them almost against their will.
Right.
When I'm talking to the Friends of Ireland in Congress, they have an appetite for hearing about it. And I think, again, as you said, we have been a template in many ways. Of course, there's no one size fits all. Every conflict has its own individual characteristics.
Yes.
But if there is one thing that I learned from my time and working with peace building at the United Nations, is that it is almost always the case when you've had a deep, deep conflict and huge effort to bring people together and a major step forward is taken towards reconciliation, you can't look away, the world can't look away, because it's wishful thinking to imagine that you can, no matter how good the outcome is, that you can stand up one day and say, thanks, show's over, it's done, we're all happy.
Feel, you know, that this is done and dusted, and that perhaps Northern Ireland and perhaps the island of Ireland might get dwarfed in terms of the volatile situation that the horrific situation that the world is in, and nobody trusting anybody else, and you know that surely to God, you know, you need Andre, you need to say, stick with us. We are, in fact, you know, we're doing it, but we can't walk away as if.
Of course, and of course, what you, in very real terms as well, you can say, surely you could not run the risk that all of that investment of effort could now be put at risk by failing to give the continuing attention that is still required. In a sense, you can turn it the other way. And rather than anybody feeling, oh, we gave all that attention and now the caravan should move on, it's the other way around. Because you have so invested in this, because you have been such a partner in this, you need to stick with it to be sure that as we come to what we hope is the closer to the end of this difficult journey, certainly, than the beginning, that we can make it together, stay together as we continue to navigate the final part of that journey. And I think that is how That is what sophisticated, mature diplomacy is like. That it's not that we are denying for a moment that the situation in Syria and many other parts of the world
right.
is urgently crying out for attention, and that the needs there aren't huge and immediate. But as I say, that's what sophisticated, mature diplomacy is. It's not either or. Because other Central African Republic or wherever, you can pick so many situations around the world that are in absolutely urgent need of attention. But it doesn't mean that you can't and shouldn't and must also remain attentive to navigating that, what we hope is close to final part of the journey in relation to Northern Ireland. And don't imperil everything we have all
right.
invested now, because you would take your eye off the ball in these later stages.
It's the Christmas season, the holiday season, and we know that there's a lot of you know, good news and only fair to middling news on both sides of the Atlantic. But I think that it would be very appropriate at this point to pass on what we've been hearing, in the neighbourhoods and in the areas, and saying that new ambassador is giving us hope. The new ambassador is actually not putting, you know, our immigration issues on the back burner. And I think there are a lot of people this Christmas, and indeed for every Christmas, you know, that have to feel the pain of not being able to go to Ireland, not being able to go back home, not being able to share with their own neighbours their plight of the undocumented. So you don't need further encouragement, because you're doing it anyway. But then we also acknowledge, of course, that you are the representative of the government of Ireland, and fair play to the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach and all who indeed have never given up on it. The fact that now it's becoming a very prime issue is all the more welcome.
Thank you so much, Adrian, and I'm so glad you emphasised that latter point as well, that it is such a collective team effort on the part of the Taoiseach, Taoiseach, the Oireachtas, my predecessors, myself.
And the President.
And while I'm touched by what you say, I really genuinely want it to be understood how much of a team effort this is. And as you say, it's coming to Christmas, so can I too take this opportunity, especially the first time on your programme, to send my Christmas wishes to all of our Irish people over here, Irish Americans, people who've done so much for Ireland. You're right, of course, and you know, we've all seen those happy airport scenes at Christmas when people go home and they're embraced, and it's a wonderful moment of reunion. And we know and feel for the people who can't be part of that because of their undocumented status. But nevertheless, Christmas is a time of joy and optimism, and Irish people have much to be thankful for in this country. There may be shortcomings, but we know what an embrace Irish people in general get in this country by and large. And it's a time for counting our blessings, knowing the issues that we need to tackle, and that we will continue to really give all our attention to in the new year. As soon as Congress is back, we're back on the doorstep again. But in the meantime, let me say to all your listeners that I wish everybody a happy, peaceful Christmas, and all good things and good tidings. Let's hope there will be good tidings in 2014, and health and prosperity.
We're delighted that we've had this opportunity with you, and that also it's coming at a time when the great news, and there is very good and positive news, and we look forward indeed to watching you closely, and indeed being there to help in any way that we can. We have a lot to be thankful for, and again, our interest in Ireland and the government of Ireland and the issues that they are addressing is something that's near and dear not just to our hearts, but I think there is enough goodwill in America to ensure that that's going to continue.
Irish America, I'm conscious of that every day of the last 3 months, and I profoundly thank Irish America for that.
Gulamila Mahagot.
Gulamila Mahagot.
Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USFX.